This week's episode of Screen Talk is sponsored by On the Record. Described by The Guardian as a landmark, no documentary has so powerfully connected the causes of Me Too and Black Lives Matter. On the Record presents the stories of Drew Dixon, Sherry Scherr, and Syl Lye Abrams as they grapple with their decision to become one of the first black women in the wake of Me Too to publicly accuse hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons of sexual assault. From filmmakers Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering, whose body of work has covered sexual assault in the military with The Invisible War, in college campuses with The Hunting Ground, and now the music industry. On the Record dives into the ways black women are too often ignored when alleging sexual assault and the cultural forces that pressure them into silence. For your consideration, On the Record is now streaming only on HBO Max. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And we have a batch of Gotham nominations to talk about this week. And we have a new president. So a lot of stuff happening in the world. So before we get into the movie stuff, I do have to ask, because last week we were talking about how we had hoped that would be our first sort of post-election podcast, and we weren't quite there yet. How did your weekend go when that news finally broke?
I was like, when a lot of people hovering over CNN for days, you know, trying to time when the big announcement would come so I could watch it live. And I missed it, of course. I was out. I wasn't watching it. I did my Saturday morning hike, and there were horns honking all over Los Angeles. Up on the hills, you could hear them all over the city. And that was a really joyous celebration. How about you?
It happened here. Yeah, same deal. We were in bed and I had been watching it on my iPad. I had basically been going through every possible screen in my household that was available at different points in time, depending on where I was, so that I could constantly be glued to this thing. I mean, it was, I resisted.
I had the TV on, the radio on in every room. I was doing a similar thing.
Of course. I mean,
what
the
was
thing
your
is,
network of choice, by the way?
Well, I think ultimately the Steve Kornacki chart throb effect was I couldn't look away. I mean, I know John King is sort of like he's got
my
that
guy.
Debonair. He's more of sort of like the Cary Grant or something of
I don't respond to him in a chart throb way. I love it that our friend Matt Brennan made up that word and it stuck.
It's pretty effective. But I think it is worth pointing out, I resisted throughout this election cycle thinking of it as a narrative, because if you look at it as a narrative, then the person who can manipulate media the most has the upper hand, and that would have been Trump. So that's why I felt like I needed
CNN
to be more active. But
CNN
had
the best ratings.
The actual
over
election
the
experience.
Few days.
It was good TV. It was really good TV. And one thing I think CNN did really smartly was once it called it, it went back to the same visual tropes that it had 4 years ago with Anderson Cooper and Van Jones. Anderson Cooper threw a question to Van Jones and he broke down crying.
Right.
And Van Jones had that dramatic monologue 4 years earlier when Trump won that was terrifying. So he got his sort of sequel moment.
We all
know.
I mean, we all learn. We all learn what works, you know. And I've been watching a lot more television. I got a kick out of the story that you did, which is a follow up to the interview I did with Stacey Abrams for All In, the Fight for Democracy. You did a nice follow up on what really is going on in Georgia.
It seemed important because the election isn't over. Right. It's not it's over in ways that our current president may not want to acknowledge, but it's not over in terms of the fight for the Senate. And it's so close that Stacey Abrams' ground game there is suddenly more important than ever before. I mean, whatever she did in Georgia, it seems like Biden will probably win that state when all is said and done. But this runoff for the two Senate seats is going to require a kind of a mobilization effort that's on another level. So it is really great to have their perspective and to have that movie, because I don't think that it's dated now. I think it's even more relevant.
No, so, and it helped to galvanize everyone. It's obvious that the Democrats across the country turned up in droves in a way that they never have before, partly because of all the activity that movies like this, other documentaries like Alex Gibney's Totally Under Control, other, you know, the John Lewis documentary. There was so
Borat.
Much material.
Give him
Sacha
credit.
Baron Cohen.
Dead vote in the end.
The trial of the Chicago 7, reminding us of what happened in 1968. People were galvanized to show up at the polls and or do their mail vote ballots. And it really made a big difference. It may have been. Hollywood helped in this particular election. All the celebrities, perhaps bored out of their minds in lockdown with no work, really stepped up in a way that I've never seen before.
Well, it was good to see that people were stepping up in ways that made sense. I mean, I was doing phone banking for Pennsylvania one day, and or maybe it was Florida. And Phil Lord was on there totally randomly. And
really?
I was just thinking about it. You know, it's just people were, I think, realizing that it's one thing to put something on social media and hope that it makes a difference. But that's kind of playing to your base in a really direct way. There was more of an effort, I think, by everyone at every level to get more directly involved. And that's why on some level, the voting process was more successful, because it's really hard to get people to understand not just that you need to vote, but you need a plan to vote. And every state has different ways of keeping you from doing that. And that's what All In really is about, is that it's difficult.
And there's been evidence apparently that in Florida, for example, the Republicans targeted the Latino vote in a more successful way. They had a better ground game. They threw in all their socialist memes, you know, and it worked, unfortunately.
Yeah, the
in
Cuban
Florida.
Vote was very
so the ground game. The ground game is a big deal. All right, so we've got our good old fashioned awards race.
Back to that old thing.
We're still tracking. And it's looking really bad right now in one way, which is that COVID is spiking all over the country. And that means that theaters are closing all over California, at least. And the long-awaited reopening of New York and LA is not going to happen. And it means that a lot of these late-breaking movies, obviously, we've been talking about this for a while, the big studio movies are moving out. But now what's going to happen to the specialty films that we're waiting for the theaters to open? And, you know, today, this week, Sony Pictures Classics, good old venerable, this has nothing to do with the Oscars, but Sony Pictures Classics, you know, finally, after 18 months, opened
they got
the climb.
I think it's relevant because The Climb should get a screenplay nomination or something.
I mean, that's a great movie. You and I both saw it at Cannes in 2019, and Sony Pictures Classics scooped it up. They got a UTA agent. They've been booking writing deals. You know, they started a production company. They've been having a career before their movie ever came out. And I ran into these guys over and over again, as you did on the circuit, because they went to every festival. This is what the Sony Pictures Classics people did. They put them in every festival, even Sundance 2020. And I would see them at the like Indie Spirit Brunch from last January.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's a running gag. You know,
I was an early fan of this. I was a big fan of this movie. I saw it right before Cannes 2 years ago and was sort of hoping that it would continue to build, and it kind of did, but it was like you say, almost this extended comedy of sorts. I went to the New York opening party, which was this Tastemakers thing a week before it was supposed to open. They were going out to LA from there to do something similar out there. And then of course that was when everything shut down. So it was like, all I could say is I'm glad that it's getting out there. I don't know who's going to theaters now or where they're seeing it, but they should if they can and they're willing.
These two guys, if you ever get a chance to run into them or see this movie, they're very, very charming together and very funny. And they're very quick-witted and they always make me laugh. Yeah, I'm on the phone with them. I did like two interviews with them and they just make me laugh.
We should also say the movie is fantastic. It's a funny buddy comedy.
Because they're in it.
Chemistry is great, and it's so innovative, from the long takes to the surreal flourishes you'll never see coming, and the kind of Altman-esque kind of bursts of violent showdowns and family scenes and stuff. It's a really edgy, fun movie.
It's unexpected too. It's one of those movies where each sequence, you're going, I did not see that coming. But the idea is they were going to go on the road with the movie. So obviously that never happened. Yeah. They were going to do stand up.
It's out there. It'll have a life, and they have careers, and they're, I think, an important filmmaking force of sorts. So that happened. And I will say, though, I can't totally comment on the entire process of the Gotham nominations. You know, that one is certainly a movie that even though it's not in this list of nominees, I've always been championing as one of my favorite movies of the year. It's certainly my favorite comedy of the year. And I hope a lot of critics
Borat's
are able to make
your
time
favorite
for it.
Comedy of the year.
Well, I think they're relative. It's a relative scale. I mean, they're two totally different categories.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
But
all right,
Borat's
so
great.
Let's do the Gotham. So you and I have the same conversation every year, and I'm not going to change my tune except for one thing. So my argument usually is that your hopes and dreams that these little tiny indies are going to make it all the way to the Oscars are futile. Resistance is futile.
Yeah, whatever. But you said Moonlight was a little movie too, so
that one had all the bells and whistles it needed, and a lot of support from the critics all the way through, and all the guilds and everything else. This time, I will change my tune to the extent that at this point, given what we were just talking about, the fact that some of these late-breaking movies are never going to open, we have movies that have opened, that have had some profile created, that are ahead of the pack. They have a bit better chance than they would have in another year. So smaller indies like Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, the Eliza Hittman, or First Cow, the Riker movie, these could have an impact. More likely is Sound of Metal. That's the one that I would, you know, Riz Ahmed got nominated, and I think he got for Best Actor.
Even in another year, I mean, you could argue that because he's so great in that movie, it leaves such a strong impression, he would be maybe a dark horse type. I mean, so it does stand the most to gain, but seeing you even mention something like First Cow in this conversation is super exciting to me, because that movie, hey, by Oscar rules, you get best feature and best screenplay. That's a big deal. That's what happened here. So, hey, it is, you know, that movie has a great narrative for the COVID year too, because they took it out of theaters because its run was interrupted by all the shutdowns, and then said they were going to re-release it, and then they put it on VOD. It seems to have done well on VOD. It's one of the more celebrated movies
she's made. And it's on the Academy portal. I don't think that's going to happen, honestly, but Kingsley Benadire, getting a breakthrough actor for One Night in Miami, he's going to get nominated, I think, for Best Actor at the Oscars. So I'm glad to see him there.
Well, what do you make of the Never Rarely thing? Because we have talked about that one on this show quite a bit.
It's all a question of what, yes, I know. It's a question. I mean, it's got awards all over it. It should be up for screenplay, but that's a crowded category. Sydney Flanagan is great as a young discovery, but I can't help but think that the Gothams and the Indie Spirits are where she's going to shine. That's just the way it is.
Well, I mean, people watch that movie and they come away with really powerful reactions to it. And if it's on that portal and it's got focus behind it, it's not, you know, it's not like they don't have the resources to push that movie along. What's missing here? What am I missing?
They do have resources. The trouble with the portal is that it's full of a lot of draws. You know, people complain about it.
A lot of junk.
Yeah, everybody's
like
just spending their
platforms.
Money. It's crowded, you know. So how do it's the same problem. What's going to be at the top of what is now, you know, this screener pile? It's the equivalent of that. And the screeners have not started showing up yet.
I want to point out one other film in the best feature category. Again, it's like I guess I'm not supposed to talk about the process, but it's cool to have a genre film in there, Relic, which to me is the strongest horror movie to come out of Sundance since Babadook. It's a really, really cool movie about Alzheimer's, but it uses the Alzheimer's format to create a monster movie of sorts. It's a really fascinating first feature Australian-Japanese filmmaker who I think really made an impression on the genre community this year. And hopefully the Gotham nomination elevates this movie
about the Oscars. Really happy when somebody shows me a title that I should catch up with, and Relic appears to be that title. I'll catch up with it.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen some of the documentaries that got nominated. I still haven't seen 76 Days. I didn't even
that's
know
really
about
good.
Our Time Machine, A Thousand Cuts. Obviously,
that's
Time
really good too.
Time is the one that, you know,
well, let's
is
make
a real
the
Oscar.
Time is extraordinary, of course. And of course, Nomadland is a front runner at the Oscars. So that's not a surprise that we would have.
She won for The Writer the last time she was not moving,
right.
So
Chloe Zhao, right.
Yep.
International feature, Baccarat was last year, Beanpole was last year. Cuties is on the short list for France, which surprised
me.
I don't think they'll put it up. I saw Cuties, and I will confess to you that while I actually feel very strongly that the director should not have been criticized for the movie the way she was, as if she was objectifying the young woman, I did feel a slight discomfort at the way
I've heard
that,
some other people say I should watch
that she
it
was
to
portrayed.
Have an opinion
I'd be
that.
Curious to hear your take.
I
understand
between.
Why people are uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, but don't give Ted Cruz too much credit here.
No,
that's part of the problem.
It's a beautiful movie. She's very gifted, and she understood what she was doing, and right. argued very strongly, because I happened to see her at the Berlin press conference. She argued very strongly that she was portraying accurately what is existing in reality, and that she
and
had the right to do that. And she does.
Understanding that, yeah. if there's a consent on both sides of the camera, then it changes the nature of the conversation. But the outrage machine went after this without even actually looking at the movie itself, because subtlety is dead to that block, and they have a different kind of agenda. So I think if they do submit it, I would hope that Netflix gets behind the movie in spite of this.
They've defended
backlash.
It through thick and thin. So. They've been quite good about it. I never saw Martin Eden. It got really weirdly polarized reviews.
Yeah, I mean it's a weirdly polarizing movie, but it's cool. I mean it's Jack London adaptation.
All right, and then Wolf Walkers is of course going to be in the animated race.
Yeah, I think that's
absolutely
interesting.
Absolutely wonderful.
Creating a space for
that.
It in the but the idea of putting it in the international category, I think that's a savvy move by that nominating committee. To acknowledge that these are movies and they can go into any number of different categories, not just animation. So
Netflix obviously got Ma Rainey out to the Gotham voting block in time for them to see it. Very few people have seen that film. So
yeah, and it's worth noting a lot of the
they
other
got
Netflix
Chadwick
movies are
on
not.
There. Yeah.
I mean, they didn't, you know, for example, Mank was not.
That wasn't
the
eligible. There's some budget cutoff. Yeah.
There's a budget. Well, it's not a specific figure like the Spirits, but it is a choice that's being made. It also has to do with there are rules about producers have to be American, things like that. So the more you drill into it, the more you can understand why certain things are not submitted. I would have liked to see the Small Axe series from or set of five movies from Steve McQueen nominated for that series category. I don't know if that was a possibility.
That's an
or
odd
if it's,
omission. Yeah,
it's a British series, so that may be why. I don't know if that those rules apply, but it's nice to see Unorthodox and Watchmen on there. Unorthodox is a German production, as far as I understand it. So I don't know exactly.
I love that movie, that series.
Great.
So I'm thinking of Ending Things got nominations for Jesse Plemons and Jesse Buckley, the two Jessies, but I don't think, except for screenplay, that really has a shot.
No, Buckley,
at the Oscars.
You know that people really like her in that. I mean, everyone's talking about that thing.
Maybe.
It's a great performance. You didn't think she was good in the movie?
She was wonderful in the movie. I just recognize that that's a movie that not that many people have seen.
You think so? I don't know.
I mean, do.
I don't know how many people liked it, but it's, I mean, I'm not talking about Academy members. I don't know exactly what the
that's
Academy
what I'm talking about.
Thinking generally speaking, it probably has done better on Netflix than it ever would have done in theaters, because it's such a bizarre kind of, you know, ending
that. I agree with that completely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So do you want to do Doc NYC?
Yeah, let's get into that, because we've been hinting at it for a few weeks. Usually we get that earlier. This year we got it after the main lineup. Doc NYC
because the
started
series,
this week.
Well, they were waiting to see. So there were about four movies that they wanted to see play out at the fall festivals. And they included 76 Days as a result of that. MLK FBI played Toronto and did well. And they've got, it's an interesting list. They left out some of the political movies like Totally Under Control and All in the Fight for Democracy, partly because they seem to think it's an interesting list, because Tom Powers and his team are on the one hand predicting what's going to be on the final 15 best
and
Oscar list,
informing.
And they're trying
they're
to inform advocate, curate.
And it's describe. Also, I mean, these are people who are programming these movies throughout the year. So playing a role in that narrative, you know.
Totally, especially Tom in Toronto. And so he has MLK FBI is one of his favorites, for example. But he also has to play I still haven't seen that one. I've seen a lot of docs, but that's one I still have to see. All right. So there's a lot of spreading the wealth. There's politics involved too, you know, in terms of spreading the wealth with the different distributors so that, you know, of all of them, Netflix has three, you know, compared to, you know, one for just about everybody else. They had to be careful.
Yeah.
So it's a nice camp is still there. Nice Boys breakdown. State is still there. You know, the big ones.
Welcome to Chechnya, which was also started. It's HBO. Run around the same time and time. And then you have Truffle Hunters. Actually, a lot of movies from Sundance, which is not surprising.
They always are. It's a thing.
I'm curious about something like Gunda, which is, you know, this incredibly experimental movie. But I mean, just relative to these other films.
It's still accessible.
Is it?
I don't judge
that well.
No.
It is very innovative.
It's a heart tugger. It makes people cry.
But it does require people to kind of commit to what it's doing in a different kind of way. I mean, I guess this year.
The narrative is, there's no talking heads. Let's put it that way.
There's no talking period. There's some grunting. But you have to watch it at home, and that's different from the theatrical.
Oh, it's gorgeous, though. So. It's one of the most stunning. I mean, there were some omissions. The Dissident didn't make it, which I think is one of the big ones about Khashoggi. And Naturno didn't make it, the Gianfranco Rossi, which may be partly because it doesn't have an announced distributor yet. But
yeah, that's unfortunate.
I love that movie. Yeah.
It's very cool. And Collective is nice. It's nice to see that on there. You know, one of the great movies about journalism, period.
Yeah, and the Romanian entry. Yeah.
For foreign. And Dick Johnson is Dead is amazing. So it's a nice range. If this is the realistic contenders for the Oscars, it's a really good scope of styles and subject matter.
So what I'll say is that 10 of these are on my Oscar predictions list. So I agree with 10 of them. And I haven't changed any of them yet. I might go in and fiddle.
Yeah.
But see more movies, I change the picks. So
I guess it'll be interesting to see if there's any kind of surprise before the end of the year. You know, as far as we know, there isn't some definitive secret movie about the 2020 election that's going to come out in December and become a, you know, late submission. But I suppose there's always possibilities, right? I mean, we've got Sundance around the corner, and Sundance will have its own kind of...
They'll have a whole new list for next year.
Yeah. So there's a lot of open questions here. Are you watching Doc NYC films? They have 108 features. So lots
there are a few
picture.
That I have to catch up with. So I have to see On the Record, for example, the Kirby Dick, Amy Swearing movie, which I've been looking forward to. There are a number of them that I'm going to still working my way through the list.
Yeah, I'm hoping to see a few this weekend. There's a documentary called The Meaning of Hitler, which obviously is a very timely subject matter, and a few others. Something called Television Event that is an all archival based documentary and looks quite strong. And I've been telling people about it this year because you can get that Doc NYC app on your Apple TV.
Yeah,
you know, my parents are going to watch Doc NYC this weekend. I think
I sent it to a whole bunch of friends. I recommended that everybody sign up and watch the movie. People are watching stuff. They need stuff to see. That's a perfect opportunity.
But exactly. The access is what makes it such a perfect opportunity. And that's why I'm kind of curious about how Sundance will go, how this virtual festival thing continues as the pandemic continues and festivals become these national events. I think it is a win for the culture, even if, you know, overall it is a business challenge that everyone has to sort out. So
I'm still very curious to see what, for example, we're talking about the docs. The likelihood is that Netflix would return to Sundance with some doc programming. They've been letting festivals go, but this is different. This is more of a launch festival. But the idea being that there may be films that were thinking of going to Sundance because they might come out in time for the Oscars.
If there's no theaters open,
yeah. Is that the plan?
You need Sundance for other things.
Yeah.
You need Sundance for distribution, for, you know, maybe a different kind of marketing launch or something like that. But it's not going to be something where it's going to be the first step in a theatrical lifespan, at least not yet. So shifting subject matters to another item from this week, should we address your surprise favorite movie of the year, Hillbilly Elegy?
That isn't fair, Eric.
No.
That is not fair. There's a difference between being a little bit provocative and saying, hey guys, this is a mainstream Ron Howard movie with two over-the-top scene-crunching performances by overlooked Oscar actresses. And the Academy and the people on Netflix are more likely to respond well to this movie than the critics are. And okay. I called that one perfectly well. I said, the critics are not going to like this movie. And boy, did they not like it.
Yeah, actually, I was surprised at how vicious these responses were. I mean, I thought the movie was pretty messy. And some of these performances were really over the top, like you say. But man, people were just like went into it from every possible angle, including the issues that they seemed to have with the original book.
So that's the real issue.
Perspective.
Yeah. And Netflix waited until after the election to open it. But I've been thinking about this a lot. I think that there are, we have to remember that filmmakers like Ron Howard and movie stars like Amy Adams and Glenn Close, with their very powerful representatives in the agency world, they carry a lot of clout in these situations. And if I were Netflix, I would have said to them, hey, we're going to wait on this one. We're not going to put this out now. But they want to be in the Oscar conversation and they want to have that chance. There's all this pressure that that those actresses haven't been nominated and this could be the one, you know? Netflix is powerful, but they don't seem to be as powerful as they could be in terms of talking back to the pressure that's put on them to put things into the Oscar conversation.
But it's not, I mean, it
should have been held back.
I mean, as you pointed out earlier, though, it could still be very popular on the platform. I mean, I know I was saying I'm thinking of ending things probably did pretty well there, but this is the kind of thing that presumably for, you know, at least around the country could do.
I think the reason that the critics are so tough on Ron Howard, and I would argue that he's made quite a few very good movies, including Rush, which I love, the racing movie. And, you know, when he gets out of unfortunately people associate him with this kind of mainstream heart tugging, manipulative.
Yeah. He's like a
bossy Hollywood, you know, movie making. And that there is a school of people who do that. And it's a specific skill that has to do with being in theaters and has to do with playing to a wide audience between the coasts and getting all those people to show up at the theaters. This is going to play what I think it will play well on Netflix, but critics really don't like that kind of filmmaking.
Well, I have to tell you, critics like Apollo 13 or whatever, you know, but there's
something.
I'm not
sure if it can. I mean, I love Apollo 13. I even think A Beautiful Mind is a good movie.
It got decent reviews when it came
Russell
out.
Russell Crowe was amazing.
It's not like it's, I think it's on some level, it's like there is just a general sense that where we're at right now, people are more excited by other things and seeing these more familiar kinds of sentimental tropes.
Well, they feel old fashioned.
Annoying.
They feel old fashioned. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I the movie has.
But the movie itself. The movie itself is, I like the documentary filmmaking. The cinematographer is Maurice Alberti. I mean that they move the camera around and get a lot of, these are based on real characters. It isn't entirely made up out of some kind of Hollywood whole cloth. I actually responded to the addiction drama of it. I did. I never read the book. I don't care about the book.
There's one scene I liked. There's one scene I did really like. There are other scenes I thought were okay, but there was one scene I really liked, and it's Glenn Close in a hospital, just choosing to get out of a hospital bed because of the way that it was filmed. And even though I thought overall, it's like, I would not have cast this movie this way. I would not have even had this person direct it. I think like, if it comes across as even a graphic
you
filmmaking,
and I both want the indie version of the movie.
Well, yeah, and cast people who live there and stuff. But But she does find some moments where she works around that challenge. So maybe the movie's worth watching just for that moment or two. But Damning with Faint Praise is certainly something that comes to mind here. So we'll see how the next couple of weeks go, though. It certainly is an unpredictable season. I mean, Netflix, as you say, has quite an end game. And
Ma Rainey is coming up. Midnight Sky from George Clooney. There's plenty more to. I think the Sophia Loren is out there at this point.
Yeah.
Before it hits the site, I'm actually looking forward to seeing The Prom just as an escape. You know,
Ryan Murphy's that on Broadway.
Musical. Me too. I liked it on Broadway.
I do miss going to those shows, so it's me nice too. When we have stuff pop up like that. So, all right, so next week, I don't know what's coming up. We've got things around the corner. DocNYC will wrap up. We'll get a chance to catch up on various different things. Maybe you can watch Relic. I'll watch, I don't know, 76 Days or something, so we can both catch each other up on what we've missed as award season continues. And hopefully they call some more states before we reconvene.
See you later, Eric.
Have a good weekend.
Take off. All right.